All right, welcome to the Canine Oasis podcast. I'm here with Steven. Is it DeBono?
DeBono, right. Yeah.
Excited to connect. I actually found you through somebody had posted an article about kind of the bad rap pit bulls get and kind of clarifying what's the reality behind the breed. And but it got to the end of the article and it listed, I think, 6 or 7 experts that contributed and you were on there. And I looked you up from there and just fell in love immediately with everything you're doing. I mean, especially helping hard to adopt shelter dogs. I mean, these are pups that are going to end up being euthanized if someone doesn't do something, right?
Yeah, that's what I've gravitated towards. I have something for those dogs that just get stuck in the system and kind of have started to really focus everything on that and doing what I can with the skills I have to help those dogs.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. So yeah, I just kind of poked around your site and then found you on YouTube and just, I love everything. I mean, playgroup. So I'm creating an indoor dog park and anybody that ends up working for me, I think it's very important that they are able to read the dog's behaviors. And so on your YouTube channel, when you take the little playgroups and break down, okay, this is aggressive behavior. This isn't, you know, and kind of how to understand it and navigate it, I think is so important.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the stuff on the YouTube, it's definitely, they're sort of like the fundamentals. I think that whenever, you know, I've worked in some daycares, and I think one of the challenges is teaching the fundamentals. And it's, I do feel like running playgroups is something that it just takes a lot of practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think what I see a lot of daycares struggle with is they do fine when you got a bunch of dogs that are easy.
Yeah.
But then when those mismatches happen, how do we prevent that from escalating into fights? Are these groups appropriate? Are these dogs having fun in the groups? You know, I think it's a challenge to run daycares. I don't envy that as a owner of there's a lot that goes into it. I mean, it sounds like from what I've read about you and what you're trying to do that you're trying to do some really important things because in a very hot climate. And yeah, I think to me, the socialization aspect of everything, like socializing with other dogs is one of the most valuable things that we can do for them if we can do them properly. Right. And that's kind of where it gets tricky.
So when I started wanting to get involved more, I put in an application just at our local county shelter and through that came across a resource. So they run play groups. I forget the name of the company, but they go around and teach
dogs playing for life, hopefully.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
And and just reading some of their data of like the number of bites and the number of adoptions and like every metric of a successful shelter moves in the right direction when you're running play groups. The one thing is that you stood out as like there's a comment you made in, I don't know if it was the email you sent or on the website, but about the really hard dogs that need it the most. And I felt like at least the training materials that I had read so far through them, they kind of exclude those dogs probably because they're trying to reduce liability with the employees and everything else, you know, and, but how do you get those really hard dogs incorporated successfully into a play group?
Yeah. So I think what, Dogs Playing for Life does, is super valuable in the sense that they're trying to get out as many dogs as possible in these groups that they're basically just trying to get dogs out as much as possible so that more dogs get stimulation. The issue with some of those harder dogs is they take time and you have to dedicate a certain amount of time to focusing just on them, which it's not easy to do. I was a director at a shelter, and doing the behavior stuff for them and various behavior capacities in different shelters. And, you know, one thing I found is like, these dogs are going to be there a long time, anyway. So if, you know, there was times, I think there's a dog on one of my videos that was there for ages and I just did it I only had time to do it maybe once, maybe twice a week. And it was just like time, we get a little bit further and eventually we get somewhere, you know, at least we're working towards something instead of just staying stagnant. And, you know, I think the, you know, I've done it in different ways and different, it really depends on the resources of each shelter. And that's kind of one thing I focus on when I work with shelters is what do these, what's the capacity that they can handle, realistically, and how do we fit a program into that? But if I say, all right, well, you know what, for an hour a week, we're just going to focus on these five long stay dogs that we're not able to include in playgroup. And we start to see where we can get them. And then there are special challenges to integrating those dogs. And that's something I've been working on kind of making systems for, because I just sort of been doing it for so long that it's kind of intuitive for me. I kind of just like, this is what I need to do. So I tried to turn that into something I can help people learn. So it's a kind of a combination, carving out as much time as you can without sacrificing the other dog's time, because you don't want to keep all the dogs inside while you're working with one dog. So you do what you can with as far as the time, and then you try to make sure you're being very skillful and intentional with what you're doing to help that dog overcome whatever that problem is. And then also it's a matter of expectation, right? So like, it might not be that I can get this dog in with the big group, you know, but maybe I can find three or four types of dogs that this dog can go out with and dedicate some time to that every day, or whatever works for that particular organization. But yeah, I'm a big proponent that, you know, the one thing you don't want to do with those long stay dogs is just park them and let them sit. And, you know, you need to always be moving forward, because a little bit of progress is eventually that stuff starts to build. Yeah. And you know, what happens when they're sitting there for ages is they're bound to make a mistake at some point. And when they make a mistake, then they become harder to adopt. They get into situations where euthanasia becomes, that's how so many dogs get euthanized. They're there for so long till they make a mistake. Then suddenly they're dangerous. And I mean, dangerous, I say. And the shelter almost has, I hate to say it, a bit of an excuse to euthanize.
I'm all about speaking truth. And I think, unfortunately, there are groups that are looking for excuses, and whether that's just the immense pressure of we can't house this many dogs, or I don't know, I came across one lady because of the dog park idea. Somebody said, hey, you need to watch so-and-so's videos. She's all about dog parks. And all of it was just super negative about why dog parks are always a bad idea, which I don't take my dog to one, then there's a reason why. But but then she went on to looking at different dogs, and it was almost like she was looking for excuses to like, nope, that one's past help. Just get rid of it. It's a bad dog. It's whether it's genetics or whatever. And it breaks my heart, because I've seen transformations of people who are willing to take time to work with a dog and figure out what's usually a fear or some kind of stress, you know, that's just not being addressed.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the only dogs that I haven't been able to find at least one friend for have been like, just, I ran out of time. Like, I just never feel like I can't find somebody for a dog. And usually, you know, I think one of the problems that I see, it's very easy to blame the dog rather than how we set the dog up. So when I'm working with people to help dogs in this way, I really try to get them to focus on what they're noticing, like understand what they're noticing. The observation part is key. You know, you're going to make mistakes in this sort of, in this, when you're doing this, and you're going to end up like, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been like, oh, why'd I do that? You know, like I did something stupid and a fight happened and I'm like, oh, and I think that's what's the key is, what did I do wrong? Not what the dog did wrong. Like, somehow I set this up wrong. I picked the wrong dog. I was sloppy at the gate. I was sloppy with my handling. I rushed something, you know, and it's too easy to say, well, that dog, you know, that's too easy. Maybe it's the dog, but not until I've explored everything that I might've screwed up or was wrong with the environment. You know, sometimes the environment itself is not right. Until I exhaust all that, I'm not going to ever say something wrong with that dog. I also think sometimes the tricky part is you can have a dog that gets into fights and has no bite history, right? And then you might have one dog that does fine until they're in the wrong situation and they cause damage. I find that to be a bit more of a challenge to work. I mean, because you're actually the risk assessment there, your risks are higher. So I think part of it is mitigating, is understanding how to mitigate those risks for those type of dogs. So whether that's muzzle training, if you have time, muzzling, and kind of really doing sort of a risk aversion calculation in your head before you do anything. What's the risk of this dog based on the information that I know about this dog, and trying to mitigate for that. So there's definitely challenges, but it's also, to me, it's like you said, it's the most fun. It's like the most rewarding thing when you can kind of see these dogs, man, they will go from tense, like bundles of tension, to just, mm-hmm. you know, and it can create such incredible changes in them. To me, number one thing a shelter should be doing, especially if they've got dogs that are sitting around for longer periods, if they're turning dogs over like 2 or 3 days, it's not a big deal. But if they've got dogs sitting in kennels, you've got to figure out a playgroup situation, in my opinion.
Yeah. Of all the pitfalls of social media, one of the things I love is people who take time to show the difference of a dog in a kennel and the effects of the stress on that, whether they appear aggressive or fearful or whatever, something that a family who's walking by looking to adopt a dog, they're like, they don't envision that being part of their home, you know, and then they'll take them out and whether it's for yard time or a play group or whatever, and it's a different dog. You know, it's, in my opinion, it's more the true dog there, because they're able to work out some of that stress and stuff. And so I love that type of work. It helps so much. So another part of what I'm doing is I'm going to create a mobile dog gym. So van with slat mills, air conditioning, so then I could go, and I could even, I think what I want to do is start with those harder dogs, especially in a shelter where they're like, hey, this one's not going to play group because we can't handle it. Great. Well, let me take them one-on-one into the van, let them run out some of that anxiety and anger and whatever else he's feeling, you know, just anything we can do to help them.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, the level of pent up that they are, that so many dogs are in those situations too. It's a stressful environment for some shelters handle it a little are better, whether it's because they're set up better for various reasons, but, it's still stressful. Even in those situations, it's like just being cooped up for that long, every day. It's definitely stressful. And, you know, I think what you said about, you know, people walking by, the dog that's reacting, freaking out, I think that's spot on. And one of the things that I really focus on when working with a shelter is really defining. So, you know, I think if you say to yourself, okay, you've got your long stay dogs, these dogs that are in a shelter for, so let's say a month. What's keeping them there, right? There are certain characteristics that are causing them to stay. So what I like to do is really identify those, and really there's what I've identified is five categories of that keep the dogs from getting adopted, five barriers that keep the dogs from getting adopted. So, and what that means is you've got every shelter, every rescue has a population of people that theoretically want to adopt from them. These five things, so it's basically their historical behavior, dog comes in with a bite history, whatever, current behavior, behavior you're seeing right now. So the barking at the kennel is a great example. Medical issues, physical traits, big black pit bull, probably going to stick around longer than, you know, full bred Pomeranian that's biting people. Yeah. You know, that it doesn't matter how friendly the big black pit bull is. It's probably going to get less interest. Right. So all these things, basically, they take that population and start to narrow it more. And so the ones that are sticking around, their population of interested adopters has just narrowed so much. So when I identify what's causing that to narrow, then I can say, okay, well, how can I expand? How can I expand this? Right. So like, how can I make this dog more interesting? How can I widen that pool for that dog? So obviously working on that kennel behavior, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And time consuming and probably unlikely, yeah. to work, unless you're really dedicated to it. And, you know, and there are things you can do to help. There's like little programs you can put into place, but I'm not going to fixate on, oh, this dog, I'm not going to let that just happen and then expect somebody to be like, I don't care. Yeah. You know, I have to figure out, okay, how can I get this dog in front of people's eyes in a way that doesn't show that, right? So, and I've done that in various ways. There's like, and I'm terrified of social media. I hate it. I have no interest in it. But with shelters I've worked with, and when I've had like a social media team, we'll come up with a social media plan that we can show people. There was one dog that we managed to get on that Dodo, mm-hmm. I think. The Dodo, yeah. And we did a little live stream with this dog, and I had already, and because he had that issue and he was a little shy with people, I taught him a bunch of stupid little tricks and stuff. He was food motivated. So we did like a 2-minute thing, and then like little, you know, showing his little tricks, and that dog got adopted that week, moved to Brooklyn. Now I still follow them on Instagram, and he goes all over the place, meets all sorts of people. You know, so another time, other places, I've had to stand with a dog and talk to people as they're walking past, mm-hmm. like, and just being like, you know, if they even look at them, I'm like, you know, I basically, hey, I'll have some sort of script or something, not script, but just something I can say to people, like, what are you trying to find out what they're looking for? And because a lot of times those dogs that are freaking out are actually the perfect dog mm-hmm. for this particular family. And you have a conversation with people, you find that out. So, yeah, I'm not sure if that answers your question.
No, yeah, it's super valuable. And it makes me think of Dogs Playing for Life, how they would, in the play areas, they would actually set up a little seating so people who are adopters could come mm-hmm. sit and watch. And they're like, oh, that's a super cool dog. Yeah. And they're like, if you'd seen him 15 minutes ago in the kennel, you wouldn't have wanted him, you know? So.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. At a shelter, and we had our Saturday and Sunday events where people came because it was shut during the week, and we would just put a bunch of dogs out in a couple of play yards, and there was another play yard that they could walk in and see, and we had people in there talking to the potential adopters. Very valuable. I mean, so yeah, it's sort of a combination of, can I overcome certain things? I can't overcome the fact that this black pit bull is a black pit bull that weighs 75 pounds and is 6 years old. You know, I can't overcome that, as far as I can't change those things. But what can I do to make this dog? I can, you know, whether it's put them in silly little outfits, put, you know, show how good he is with other dogs, show him, do some cute little tricks. What can I do? And again, little by little, if you have to, because it's better than them just sitting there waiting for the right adopter. You know, you have to be proactive with these dogs. And and look and actively help them overcome some of these obstacles.
Yeah, I love it.
That's what I love doing.
Yeah. I remember seeing a post about she was a groomer in California, and she had taken a dog. I don't remember the breed or anything, but she had made it have leopard spots, like dyed the fur. And a bunch of people are like, that's horrible. Mm-hmm. That's abuse. You're doing that for you, not for the dog. And then somebody chimed in and said, hey, what you don't know is that dog was in the shelter for 600 days and no one looked at it, mm-hmm. but because she did that. And then all the mm-hmm. people are like, oh, that's so cool. And now they're looking at it and realize he's got a great personality and he got adopted, you know, and
right.
if not, that dog would have been euthanized. And so,
yeah, that's brilliant. That's a, you know, that totally what can make that dog stick out, you know, in a positive way rather than negative. And that's what's going to expand that pool of adopters, of potential adopters. And I know, you know, there's always pushback, not always, but there's certain shelters that'll give you pushback on some of the more tricky behavior dogs that, well, we don't want them to get adopted by anybody. They need a specific special home. Well, yes, but you don't want a zillion people all wanting this. That can be just overwhelming to deal with. And just time consuming. I understand that, but that's a good problem to have, honestly, when, you know, then we can start to filter through. It can be a little more challenging when you're dealing with like a little dog with a serious behavior problems and you want 600 people want this dog. And you have to tell people, no, you can't have this dog. You've got a 3-year-old kid and, you know, all this stuff. And that's the fifth obstacle that I didn't mention was policies that shelters have and the rescues have sometimes limit over, you know, I think you have to examine your policies to make sure you're not excluding people that would be good adopters. Mm-hmm. I know you do. I do agree. You have to have. You know, you don't want to, you want to keep the dog safe. You want to keep the people safe always. And that's always your primary objective or your goal. So yeah, you just have to take that into consideration. It's just that sometimes shelters will just exclude perfectly good adopters, because of some arbitrary rule they have or whatever. And it's just like, mm-hmm. let's have a conversation here. Let's see if this is the right person. It's hard. It's not, you know, nobody's saying it's easy, but it's definitely.
For sure. You got to have those policies because you're trying to keep things safe. But then if a line of script on a paper is making your decisions for you, I think something needs to be reassessed. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that a lot lately of perfectly adoptable dogs that they're like, nope, they can only go through a rescue. So you have somebody like dog mm-hmm. trainers I know that are ready for another dog and they could handle the dog perfectly mm-hmm. well. Well, now you got to go through the bureaucracy mm-hmm. of going and either signing up, going through all the paperwork and everything of being an official foster and things like that to be able to get the dog in your home.
Oh, really?
And it's like, I don't know. I think you could look at the person's credentials and say, okay, like this makes sense. But yeah.
Yeah. Like, I'm not sure I understand the point of that really.
Yeah, I get it if they have like medical issues and so they want it to go through a foster so that the people can get help. Mm-hmm. But if somebody rich came in and said, I don't mind, I'll pay the bill. Like, all right, send them with them, you know?
Right.
So I don't know.
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. If somebody's willing to work with that dog, it's like, you know, let's, you know, you can still support the people as far as whatever, I mean, whatever they need, you know, and I think that's a big part of it too, is it's not just about placing the dog. It's what support do you provide? If you're going to have dogs with some behavior issues getting adopted, you're always going to, but if you're going to have that, what kind of support do you provide? What are you going to do to help that dog stay in the home? So there's, you know, first of all, it's the right placement. Like there is a big, especially, yeah, there is a big part of it is making sure it's the right placement. Mm-hmm. At the same time, not trying to play God with it. Like there's times where I'm like, ooh, and then it turns out to be perfect, you know, and you just have to kind of, you just have to kind of trust people a little bit I'm not think that you know, a lot of it's swallowing your, you don't know everything. You don't know these people. You don't know what their situation is, what their dedication is necessarily, how much they're willing to learn. They might not know anything now, but they might be very willing to listen, do what's right for the dog, you know? So yeah, I think, and then, yeah, the support, so the placing the dog and then, you know, giving support materials, I think, is important, especially if you're, you know, you know that this dog has been returned because of a resource guarding issue. You want to make sure they understand what that means, what the basics of what they need to do, and then whatever you can provide. You know, again, every organization is different, what they can provide. How can you provide more? Is it kind of like getting a relationship with a trainer that knows what they're doing, which is a whole other thing. But yeah, so the challenges are there. That's for sure. But I think that there are things that are very easily, like very low hanging fruit that most places can take to really kind of start moving these dogs along in a safe, responsible way. And that's, you know, I'm definitely not just get them out, right. just get them out. The staying there is important to me, and making sure it's safe.
Yeah. I love, coming across trainers who do foster. And so they'll take some of those dogs and then take them to their house, work with them, maybe do a spotlight video of like the before and after, and then that makes them highly adoptable at that point, you know?
Yeah. It could be, you know, you gotta be careful with that too. I mean, you know, this is just one story, but there was one dog. It was like right when I was starting at a shelter. And so I didn't know the dog so well. But this one trainer had offered to take him, within couple of weeks. He had bitten a guest, decided, okay, well, we're gonna have to euthanize this dog, because the trainer said, you know, this. Then another time, like maybe 6 months later, there was a dog that I knew really well, and I knew he posed some risk, but I also knew it was pretty easy to deal with, but she had offered to take him. Same thing happens. 2 weeks later, the dog's got a bite history. It's a German Shepherd, full German Shepherd. And when I found out what she did, I was like, the sort of method of introduction to the guest, I was like, well, that was the wrong thing at every step. Long story short, ended up like the dog ended. I managed to keep this dog safe, and it wasn't easy, and it cost me a lot, because I was not letting this dog. I love this dog. I was not letting him get killed. Another shelter in Austin took him. This dog ended up going from New York to California to Austin. And for last 3 years now, has been living really nicely in a home. The person loves him, lives with cat, is just, I was not surprised by this. It's just, but you see, like, it's like people, it's sometimes, I mean, I don't want to crap on trainers, but sometimes you have people that take things that they can't handle. Mm-hmm. Then because they've got this credential, they try something that, and they don't do it. And that dog pays for their lack of skill. And so
it's interesting that this has come up,
you know, I learned,
because in my notes of things I wanted to talk to you, and when I'm like, I don't know if I'll get into it, cause it could be, you know, it could hit sensitive skins, but just a thought I had this morning of like, sometimes people don't know how to stay in their lane, and you can always expand your capability beyond your current lane. But I've seen that with, like maybe it's a brand new positive reinforcement only. And they're like, I'm going to take this challenging dog. And then they can't handle it. And they're like, oh, it needs to be euthanized, you know, or whatever, you know, any school of thought of training, but see that with other people who are like, yeah, I'm going to work with a bite dog. Well, how much experience do you really have? You know, and the trainer that I ended up hiring, he's like, you know, I did an internship with bite work and stuff, and it's really interesting, but why would I jump into that when I know this guy over here who's been working police dogs for 30 years is going to do it better and safer. Mm-hmm. You know, if he wanted to, he could go work there and expand that. But I feel like sometimes, and I don't know, it might be that social media thing too, or just ego of like, I want to be the person that can do it all. Mm-hmm. Without going through the proper channels to learn.
Yeah. I mean, I think ego is a, and look, I think I have an ego. I mean, I'm certainly not lacking an ego, but at the same time, I feel like I'm conscious of it, and I'm conscious. And I think it's not everybody's got an ego. It's about understanding, like trying to make sure that the ego isn't making decisions for you. It's saying, yeah, and ego comes in a lot of different ways. It's like, I have to protect myself against things like I really want something to work. Like I want this dog to get with this dog. Do I actually think this is a good match, or is it the right time, or does my ego just want it so badly? Does my ego want to be able to tell the owner of this dog that I got him with another dog? Yeah, there's ego plays in a lot of different ways. And I think in the way you said too, is like, I can do it, where it's false bravado almost. And yeah, I mean, it's hard because I'm trying to think back to when, like, how I ended up working with these dogs, because you have to start somewhere. You have to, you know, at some point you have to, you know, and I don't even remember really, like, it just sort of happened. I think probably working in the shelters, I just was. The way I started working with shelters was Austin Pets Alive, is a organization in Austin, and I volunteered for them going to the city shelter. They'd have a list of dogs, and we would just evaluate the list of dogs that were going to be euthanized that night or within the next couple of days or something. And we would have to go in within 2 hours and evaluate these dogs for the program, see if we could take them. And so I think I got really lots of handling experience, and that's the handling experience. It's not really focused on in sort of training schools and stuff. I mean, there's a lot of trainers that just aren't that experienced with handling multiple types of dogs, multiple energies, aren't understanding how to modulate their own energy to kind of meet that dog. So yeah, I mean, practice. It's just, how do you practice with a bite? I think you have to do those kind of lower stakes things, maybe, where it's not this dog's, you take a dog where it's a life or death situation, you better know what the hell you're doing, and it's scary. It is. I get scared, you know, I don't want to mess up. Cause you just learn how little you know the more you do this.
Yeah.
I think you really do. It's just like, you think you know stuff, and then what?
Yeah. And I think, unfortunately, the way the system's set up too, the dog's the one that bears the brunt of our mistakes. You know, they get that bite. Now they have a bite history.
Yeah. Nobody's blaming the handler, the dog, the person, the trainer, especially. It's at the dog's fault. It's always the dog's fault. And it's like, well, you know, that's what I'm saying. Like, you gotta, where did we go wrong? Where did we fail before we go to the dog's thing? You know, there's been situations where, like, I've had a dog that over time we just couldn't figure out, like, just random. It seemed random. It's still to this day. And I made the decision with this dog that we can't place this dog safely. And still to this day, I'm like, what did I, you know, like it kills me because I'm like, oh, I wonder what I missed there. You know, I wonder if I missed something. And I don't know, you know, and I think it's just so important to really, really look into detail into what happened. And this is my advice for, like, whether you're dealing with any training situation, it's really about noticing things, like really noticing. And when you notice exactly what's going on, and you really can, you know, it's a puzzle you're putting together. If you can get that puzzle as complete as possible before you even do any intervention, the intervention almost, like, it like makes itself obvious in a way. If, you know, we all have our techniques and skills, but you're like, all right. And you can really directly kind of overcome the behavior issue or whatever.
So did you work for shelters before college? And when you went to school, was it wanting to work with dogs, or was it just like a branch of the psychology?
Yeah, it was, it was just a random, it was very kind of like random. I was working at Austin Pets Alive at the time. And this is in Austin, obviously. And I just had learned about this psychologist that was doing a bunch of dog personality studies. And I reached out to him, Dr. Sam Gosling. And he invited me to come for him just to meet him. He then like offered me a job as a research assistant, and I was just like, this is cool, you know? And I was like, that sounds cool. So they were basically contracted by the TSA, I guess, or the, can't even remember now, but the San Antonio Air Force Base had a breeding program for explosive detection mm-hmm. dogs. And they had contracted them for like a 5-year program to study that program and improve. They're doing all sorts of things with genetics, identifying personality at an earlier, being able to identify what dogs would be good explosive dogs at an earlier stage. So I started research assistant, and then they offered me like basically like a, that I could go into the program, as a student. So I did that. I was like, hell yeah. And I did that. Then they shut down that program, the program. And I think he got out of, dog work, 'cause it was tricky. The personality work is pretty tricky. So basically I ended up going to Australia and doing studies on the Australian explosive detection dogs or drug detector dogs. They do mostly. I learned a ton. I mean, it was cool. It was really cool. But I also just learned a lot about problem solving and beyond dogs. So it was a dog. It was a human program technically, my work was primarily with dogs. But then I had to do all the stats classes, a bunch of human psychology classes. But I feel like those are super valuable to me, because a lot of the stuff applies. You know, it hasn't been applied to dogs yet, and there's certain things that really apply and you can kind of incorporate into your problem solving. And I think just learning how to, it really helped me learn how to approach a problem. Mm-hmm. I think. So then, yeah, after that, I got my master's there. Then I opened a facility in Austin where I was working with clients primarily, like the public primarily, but then also shelters would send me dogs. And that was pretty cool. It's a cool facility. And then I got an opportunity. I was kind of burned out after a while. My family's all in New York. I got this job opportunity there with a shelter. I wanted to get back in the shelter. I liked the shelter stuff better than working with the public. No offense, public. But then I moved over back to New York. Job didn't. I mean, it's kind of like talking about the long stay dogs. I got in there. They had something like 150 dogs that had been there for over a month. I was there for like 5 or 6 months, and 70% of those I got adopted. But, you know, there's a lot of red tape with those big shelters, a lot of disagreements, and moved on basically to other shelters. Kind of learned that I do better on my own than having somebody trying to screw up what I'm trying to do. So now my wife and I moved to Oklahoma City for her job. So now I've been mainly focusing on like working with kind of doing consulting, because I think it's a better fit for me. I also think it helps, because when I worked in the shelters, what would happen over time was you start getting, or at least me, I started getting sucked into the norm instead of seeing what was wrong with the norm. I think it helps me to just see it from the outside. I think it's beneficial to have an outside view of what, because you get so stuck into the day to day that you can't think beyond that. So I think it's a better fit for me to do that kind of thing. And so I'm doing seminars. I did a seminar, like doing seminars with socially challenged dogs and things like that.
That's awesome. Yeah, that outside perspective is so valuable. I saw a video on LinkedIn this morning, and it was a guy talking to executives, and I can't remember the term. It's like the highest paid person's opinion or something like that, HIPPO. And he said that's like a thing in corporate America is like, all right, everybody, let's defer to the guy who's making the most money in here. And he's like, that's just nonsense. Mm-hmm. The guy who's making the most money should talk last. And he's like, and you'll see where like a CEO or whatever ends up promoting directors and managers and stuff that all feed into his vision of things. And he's like, you really need people in your organization who disagree with you, who can kind of put you in check and give you that outside perspective on what you think is a great idea. Maybe they poke a few holes in it and it doesn't feel good, but it's super valuable.
Yeah. No, I agree 100%. I think that it's kind of weird. Like you'll go into a situation, you'll see all these things that need to be changed, and you start to make these changes, and then you almost forget like some of the things that also needed to be changed. And it is helpful. I think. So I do think it's helpful to kind of get outside perspectives. And also I think, you know, you can do it if you're there, but it really does take talking to a lot of people, even if you're within the structure, and then taking those steps back, looking what other people are doing is really important too in those situations. What are other people doing? Like, how are they handling certain problems that you have? You know, it's sometimes not apples and oranges, how different shelters are set up and how but you still can learn from everybody. And I think it's really important to get that objective view, really.
That's awesome. Yeah. So another topic I wanted to talk to you, just, I don't know, I appreciate how authentic you are and like you do your thing.
Thanks.
On your website, you mentioned that you don't use, you know, like e-collars, prong collars and stuff like that. And you're working with hard dogs. And so I was wondering, like, what are some of the benefits and maybe barriers of your approach, and how did you end up there? I mean, working around bomb dogs and drug dogs, I imagine you have experience around tools like that and stuff. But
so this is, you know, it was really interesting. The Australian, which they've got the premier, as far as I know, the premier drug detector kind of program. It's all positive. The Air Force, they were copying that system basically, and they were doing all positive, is all reward based, no shock collars. I started, my first job as a trainer was with a company that used prong collars. The owner would use shock collars and he tried to teach me on them, but I really didn't like it. I saw a dog really crumble with it and I was like, I'm not doing this. The prong collars, I have less of a problem with. It's more that I think they're too there's negatives to me. What I found was I could use them properly. I had a hard time getting the owners to use them properly. So what I was ending up seeing was increase in reactivity, I would say, or an increase in, because a lot of these dogs were coming to daycare as well. So I would sort of see them, their personalities change with the other dogs in the groups and stuff. So even if it was stopping with the prong collar, like if the reactivity was stopping. So I think sometimes the prong collars and stuff will give the illusion, like they suppress behavior, right? That's what they're meant to do. And it's sometimes what you think you're teaching a dog is not what they're actually learning. And the hard thing about talking about this stuff, I think, is that, you know, and a lot of the positive trainers will tell you, this is always going to do this. It's like, all right, no, 75% of the time, that might not, 90% of the time, it might not cause this issue. 10% it might. For me, I'm going to try to prevent, like, not, like, it's sort of the do no harm thing. I'm going to try to do anything I can to not cause discomfort, discomfort, pain, whatever, you know, that kind of thing with the dog. That doesn't mean I don't set limits. Doesn't mean I don't, you know, have rules. I'm not the type to just say, you just ignore, you know, that I'll use timeouts, things like that. You know, I think that things like the gentle leader, the no pull harnesses can help with a lot of the problems that people have. You know, if I had like an, you know, a frail 85-year-old woman with a 70-pound, you know, mastiff or something, would I consider using a prong collar with her if she, you know, if we had to? Yeah, I mean, because ultimately the first thing I need to do is neutralize the dog's strength with the person. The dog can't outmuscle the person. So, you know, for me, I try not to get wrapped up in the positive, in that sort of war, though I very much lean towards reward-based, I don't use any of that stuff. I have a huge, huge problem with the companies that slap shock collars on everybody, which is what dominates in Oklahoma, it seems. That the first line of intervention is shock collar. Again, it's really not about the tool itself, or it's about the person having to learn how to use it in a responsible way. And I think people get caught up on whether it hurts or not. And this, I think, is important. And it's not really about how much it hurts. It's a problem, but the thing that isn't really thought about is it's the stress of knowing, it's the difference between taking a battery, you know, and putting it on your tongue, and it's like, eh, whatever, or getting like a carpet shock that you're not expecting. It's not that it hurts. It's that the surprise, it freaks you out, right? And we can say, oh, it was just the carpet. But imagine we didn't know what the hell it was, you know, why was that, you know? So so for me, like, I do think, like, there's people that use these tools super responsibly. I also think that there's way too many that use them irresponsibly. I also think, going back to what you were saying about people taking on more than they can chew, like, the positive trainers better know what they're doing it's not enough to just be positive. You got to be good,
right?
You know? And same with anything. It's really not about it's about being good, identifying the problem really thoroughly and properly, getting an accurate perception of what the problem is. Doing some sort of intervention and understanding where the drawbacks may be, whether using positive, whether using your other tools, because there are, and anybody tells you there's not, for any of those things, there's drawbacks. I don't care. There always is. And understanding that, looking for the signs that whether these things, you know, are, and making adjustments along the way. Again, you're going to make mistakes, all these things. But when you make a mistake, you also want to make sure that the damage is limited, whether it's to a human, whether it's to the dog, it's themselves. I think it's most important. And I don't know how you find, like, people ask me, how do I find a good trainer? I'm like, I don't know.
Like finding a good therapist, you just try and waste money and finally find a good one.
Yeah, and you just hope they don't screw you up more. But, like, I mean, I think, you know, I do think, length of experience is important. Like, how much experience do they have is probably an important aspect. I don't know. It's hard for me because I can kind of detect bullshit pretty easily when I'm talking to it. So it's hard for me to sometimes I'll just say, just send me the websites and I can tell you, like, this looks okay. Yeah. This looks, but that's pretty crude assessment. So I think experience, I feel like buzzwords, when they're using a lot of buzzwords, I'm like, you know, when they're using things like, even if they're just focusing on how positive they are, you know, or whatever, or we don't like positive, we're balanced. We don't know. It's sort of, I don't know. I don't know. It's hard. I think also if you're looking for dogs with like to deal with behaviors that are on the realm of fearful and aggressive type behaviors, how they talk about that to me is really important. If they're labeling, if they're quick to be like, oh, he's dog aggressive, or I'll fix your dog aggressive, you know, to me, then I'm like, no, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, and I know sometimes we have to use these words for communication, but when you start labeling, that means you're not looking at what's actually happening. So, you know, I'll describe things as aggressive behavior because it's describing a behavior, but you'll never hear me call a dog aggressive, call a dog, say something was aggressive. You know, I just don't think labeling is in that way is helpful at all. It's really about what the behavior, how it's manifesting. So that's another way it's like, how are they talking about this stuff?
It's important. I think there's some ag campaigns running right now that exactly what you're saying, like I just see them and I cringe because they're leaning real into that very heavily. So the reason go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'm just gonna, this is one of the issues with like why I can't stand the social media stuff. I mean, I'm terrible at it because I can't generalize that well. Like I have a hard time with the generalizing of behavior. I don't have the ability for it really. But it's when you're trying to these little 1 minute clips, you have no choice but to basically categorize things. And while in one way I love that training gets more like publicity and stuff from it, I also think I just hate it. Like I just get so I watch it and I get so annoyed.
So the reason I brought that up though is one of my goals is to kind of bridge the gap. So growing up, I just thought there was dog trainers, you know, and then you start looking into it and I kind of don't like the labels. I think the more people accept them, and especially when they identify by them, then they start like putting themselves in a box. And kind of what I saw with your content is you're avoiding those boxes. You do what works for you. It's very well thought out. And so I want to have those types of conversations more, maybe to give other people who feel like they're balanced, but they don't like what they're doing, or positive reinforcement, or whatever it is. Like, let's break down those labels and just say, hey, what's working, what's not, what's really working too, because I think you can mask things pretty easily in a lot of ways. But I hate how much fighting there is. Like there's one lady who she's created this profile on TikTok all about, this is a safe place for no matter what. And so you go in and like you mention anything about tools and you're Satan and all this stuff, like she just starts attacking you. And I'm like, wait, I thought this was a safe place to talk, you know? And it's gross to me. And so I got a couple of rules when I'm following people. I don't care what camp they are in. If their social media consists of talking about what somebody else is doing wrong, then I won't follow them. I'm not going to give them my time or attention. I love people who just do their thing and promote it and show why it works and stuff. And so I'd like to break down that huge divide, and just the way people talk, like my balanced friends that just talk about throwing trees, like very, it's like dehumanizing the way they talk about people who do. And it's like, that's 90% of what you do too, you know? And then on the flip side, talking about, you know, positive reinforcement, balance, like punishing and this and that. And I'm like, okay, so the guy I hired, he would fall in the balance camp. And the very first thing he did is like, let's take everything off and we're going to spend a day or two working on your relationship with your dog, you know? And, and then we talked about, cause I wanted my dog to be a hunting dog. And so I talked about the e-collar and he's like, okay, we don't introduce that until he's 100% on everything else because it's a communication tool. It's not a corrective tool. And so I really appreciated his approach with that. And, you know, people talk about shocking dogs and how horrible and punishing it is. And I'm like, remember the last three times I used it, it was on a 3 out of 100. I can't even feel it on my skin. My dog's not jumping or yelping, you know? And, so I don't know. I feel like we could get a lot more done for the benefit of dogs if we stopped fighting and just did good things, you know?
Yeah, and I think I think it's focusing on the wrong things is the I think that focusing on the diagnosis in a sense or the getting the perception, like, yeah, if people are using these tools and really being honest with their clients and it's a totally, you know, the thing is it's not as black and white as all that. I don't have a problem with people calling out the shot collar, you know, they go 3 weeks, like 3 weeks of training and then they're slapping shot collars on their dogs. Like the trainers get trained for 3 weeks on these shot collars. Then they're given clients. And like, how is that responsible in any way? I don't have any problem with people calling them out. Because I think the awareness is important because otherwise people don't know. They just see dogs sitting on boxes really still in videos and doing really impressive things. And they've like, I want that. And I think it's important to make sure that people understand that these tools aren't just, you know, the way they're intended to be used is exactly the way your trainer did, which was it's for proofing. And like, once you've gone through everything else and the dog is, you know, and then it's like, and then you're going to use it for proofing if with the right dog and, you know, you're really using them carefully. It's a totally different thing. So trying to lump people, that person in with that company that's doing that is just ridiculous. Yeah. It's, I think it's a very nuanced problem, and I don't know, you know, you'll notice, like, I used to have like certification through APDT or the CPDT thing, and I just started I don't want to be part of this, this whole thing of, I have to, you know, it's really to me about how can I understand what is going on in this situation with this dog, from working with a client, with this dog and this human in this environment, right? Three things that are interacting with any behavior. It's dog interacting with the person in an environment. What is changeable? How do we change it, basically? Mm-hmm. What's avoidable? What's changeable? Can we change it? How do we change it? You know, and do it with, how can we do it while minimizing the likelihood of any damage to the dog,
unwanted effects.
Exactly. Unwanted effects. Yeah. Like, we don't know what they're learning. We're trying to teach, but we don't know what side effects are happening, and we want to limit the potential of any negative ones from happening. Yeah. So that's how I look at it. And I just, again, that's kind of why I just don't really engage with a lot of the training stuff, sort of, I don't know. I mean, I did for a long time, but I don't know. I also don't really, like, at this stage, I don't do as much training. It's really mostly the socially challenged dog stuff, working with those dogs. And the training that I do is more behavior, helping dogs overcome fear and things like that, helping socialize them with the world. Is primarily, so I'm not really doing a lot of sort of the training these days.
I love it. I don't know. I love everything you're doing. I definitely would love to have you back.
I mean, it sounds like, I'd love to.
Last thing I wanted to hit you with was, you mentioned reading books as being a great way to learn. So what's your number one book recommendation
Number one book. Where did I mention that?
Probably the email to me.
In the email. Oh yeah. I don't know if there's one book. Like, what I generally recommend is, the one probably would be, Obstacle is the Way. It's a book by Ryan Holiday, who basically, my whole behavior adjustment system is based on that book. Because basically it's kind of funny because divides problem solving, just general problem solving, into three sections: perception, action, the will. Now, notice what that spells out: perception, action, will, paw.
Oh yeah.
So it was like, whoa, that's perfect. So But basically, it's getting a really accurate view of the problem, like I've said over and over, deciding what actions are going to directly help overcome those problems, and then having the will to see through. So that's when I'm working with clients, that's really important to say, like, okay, this is what I know this dog needs. I have to try to make an assessment. What's this dog, this person, this owner capable of, whether it's physically capable with time, whatever it is. And I'll kind of go through it. Do you think you can do that? You know, because I want to make sure I'm giving them actions that they have the ability to follow through on. And so that book, really, really strongly recommend that book for anybody that's trying to solve any problems, really. Like, I just use it, just a problem solving thing, really helpful. But I'd also say just reading lots of things outside of the sort of dog literature thing, because you learn a lot about communication. There's a book I read, I can't remember what it's called. It was just about the play of animals. And it was really just like studies of mice, all this stuff about animal play. So stuff like that. I mean, habit building, like you can read about all sorts mm-hmm. of stuff and apply it to the thing. Otherwise, you're just reading the same dog books everybody else is reading. You're just it's just a circle of echo chamber. Yeah. And there's so much knowledge out there that is applicable that hasn't really been applied to the dog world. So my advice is read about other animals, read research, you know, go on Google Scholar, and there's research papers, different psychology things that you can read about that I learned a lot. So I'd say that would be my one thing. I don't know that I have, but the Obstacle of the Way is a book I would definitely recommend to anybody. There's that's a good one. There was one called if I was going to recommend a dog book, I'm not up to date on the latest, but Suzanne Clothier she has a great book, Bones Would Rain from the Sky, which really changed my view on a lot of things. She's awesome. I think everything she does is great. She also recommended a book that I read that I thought was great, was called Life Lessons from a Ranch Horse, which I remember reading, and that had a strong effect on me. It's been almost 15 years since I read it, but I remember really liking it at the time. And it's kind of like this guy who, he's a ranch, you know, he's got horses, and he gets a dog horse that's really challenging, and he learns basically not to fight the horse.
Yeah.
And he learns a lot about, you know, it's awesome. Good. But yeah, I think getting outside the sort of dog literature and reading other things is really helpful.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I really enjoyed talking to you. We'll want to stay in touch.
Awesome. It was great. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Good luck. This is sounds awesome what you're doing. I listened to your podcast with the
Tina
Phoenix Farm Girl. Tina, yeah. That was really entertaining. I'm kind of jealous. I want 75 farm animals.
Yeah, she's pretty amazing.
Sounds awesome.
Cool. Yeah. Well, cool. Thanks for coming on, and
all right.
Yeah, let's talk again.
Thanks for having me.